General Novan, beginning of Suzanne's report this Tuesday after supper, the 22nd of August, 72. General Novan, beginning of Suzanne's report after supper, the 22nd of August, 72. Channel 2 over, and beginning of Suzanne's report, this Tuesday after supper, the 22nd of August, 72. Channel 2 over, and beginning of Suzanne's report, this 22nd of August, 22nd of August, 72.
Good morning. Is that green? I like the, I know it's not a kind of color, but if you like that color, it's a little chocolate. Yeah, it's not real creamy. It's a little brown.
Napkin, something. We've got a lot of crumbs over here. You know, this this little thing about the Hobart, you can work it. You have to have some little way of handling the Hobart children. And you see the way Suzanne brought it up here was, or in a letter, that before you jump me about talking to children.
Yeah, we enjoyed it.
Here's this six-year-old can report.
Yeah.
So what it is, you see, is one little revelation after another. And then the middle one that's deficient.
Yeah. That was Nell's discovery that she passed on to me. So I could see.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because all they'd done up to that point was come over and run around and watch. And none of them hadn't talked too much.
Yeah. Now, did you see this all at once about the loose?
Yeah. It was just, I was on the porch not too happy about having to sit there and keep him occupied until he decided to go off. Because I thought he'd be like Scotty. But not, I just wouldn't. And he got into something. He'd been talking about his brother. And then he got into this story about his father killing the snake. And it came to me that he was talking. He was reporting. He had the circumstances. And he was telling it straight. And he was has just that little bit of, when a person is telling something and they know they're telling something good,
yeah.
they have that sense that they're entertaining or something.
Oh. And you had an audience.
And you had an audience because all of a sudden I wasn't treating my little six-year-old boy. I wanted to hear him talk.
Yeah.
So I didn't talk. And it came to me, I think, when he gave a snake going down the hill with his hands.
Yeah.
Just revolved his hands as the snake flipped down the hill. And you could see he was seeing it, and I could see it. And I said, you know what you do sometimes where you make him go back and do it over again. How'd you say you went down the hill? And he went back and showed me again. And he kept it up. And Nell was inside. She could hear some of it, and she came out later, and she said she didn't want to come out because she didn't want to stop him.
That's nice. Right.
And when, but when she did come out, he was still talking, and he has, it was this time, it was something about his brother stirring up a wasp nest, the, just fooling around playing. And his brother stirred him up and took off running, and Douglas was just a little bit behind. He'd just been off to the side watching, and he looked at Nell and he says, "And you know who got stung?" And he stopped, just that pause. And we looked at him, and he says, "Me." I'm pointing with his thumb. So he, you know, he knows how to tell a good story.
6 years old.
Yeah.
You told about the wasp and the snake and.
Oh, and a rooster. He'd seen jumping out and up and down out in the pasture. So he got Dwight, the one who knows about snakes and things, to come out with him. Dwight caught the chicken and the snake. And, well, they saw it was a snake that the chicken was fussing around. So they caught them both and put them in a pen together and watched what would happen. And the chicken killed the snake. And he said it just jumped all over it and spurred it and pecked at it and it killed the snake. It about chewed its head off.
Yeah. It just doesn't sound right for a bird to kill a reptile.
No, it was kind of a, that's why they keep, he's, well, part of this I got from Mr. Lyons about those game roosters. They can take care of themselves. And your Douglas was seeing it too. That's why they keep those kind of roosters, because they don't lose as many of them.
Oh.
There are a lot of, and this is the kind of thing that he gets from his brother and his father or somebody, I guess. I don't think he could know it himself. That the fox are bad around there, and the possums and the coons, and they get the chickens and the biddies. And so the game hens and roosters seemingly survive a little longer because they can take care of themselves. And he'd seen this one just fighting with the snake. And he was talking about snakes then anyway, about the different kinds his brother had caught. And he'd had a pet snake for a while, big black snake, I think it was. And it just, one thing would lead into another. He'd skip. Sometimes things would throw him onto a different track that I couldn't see where he'd switch. But for a while, he had his father kill the snake out in front of our shack by the hickory tree. And then he went on to the chicken that killed the snake. And then went back to his father shooting a dog he'd seen after his chicken. Seen this dog chasing a chicken. He's probably come out on the porch and said, "You goddamn dog's not going to get my chicken." And the little boy, you know, Douglas would repeat it. And he said, and he just blew his head off. And it's,
well, he saw that.
He saw that, yeah. He goes around with his father all the time. If you see his father, the little boy is usually right on his heels. If he can do it.
Well, there would be no end of what he could tell you.
That's right, yeah. Because he, when he comes over, now I didn't see this, Mel told me, he said when he comes over with his father, his father's come over a couple of times, I think, and the little boy didn't say a word. You know, you just, it'd be like just pulling teeth to get anything out of him. And I saw him do this with his mother. He didn't say a word while she was. Yeah. But he came over with his brothers one day. They were pulling him in his new wagon. And he'd talk and talk and talk. Just chatter away, Mel said. He just, you couldn't shut him up, she said. And the older boys would punch him and tell him to shut up. He didn't know what he was talking about. He wasn't there. He'd say, "You don't know what you're talking about." And he'd be quiet a minute. And then she said he'd start right back in again as soon as they got on something else. And he just, for a long time, we didn't think any of them would say a word. They just kind of come over and stand around and look. And say goodbye and leave again.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that's like, you know, I would write, you know, this, you can't get three words out of them in 30 minutes. Those would be yes, no, and I'll see you. And then all of a sudden, they were talking. Or else we were just, you know, just were listening for them. And giving them a chance to talk.
But Nell is the one who saw the next one.
Yeah. He'd come Melvin. Over. Dwight.
Dwight, yeah.
Yeah. Poochie, they call him. That's his nickname, Poochie. And he'd come over to ride his bicycle, and he'd ask her, he says, is it all right if I ride over here? You don't mind me riding here? She'd say, no. And he'd ride off for a while, and he'd come back, and she said he'd ask, do you have any other places I can ride? And she'd show another path that she thought he might ride his bike on, and he'd ride there. And she said, when he got through, you know what he did? He said, thank you. And he went on. She said, I never heard such a thing. A little boy riding his bicycle and then thanking you for letting him on your place. And he talked, evidently, and she was coming up the hill to help us up there. And I'd been helping all morning. She'd been fixing lunch. And she just kind of brought it up. She said, you know that Dwight? She said, the one they call Poochie? His Lyons told me, and his mother told me, that he couldn't learn in school, and something was kind of wrong with him, with his mind. She said, but he's got a lot of sense. And he'd just been talking to her, she said, about quail and deer and snakes. And she said he knows just all sorts of things about animals around here. And she gave a couple, she tried to remember a couple of things he told her about. The quail was the first thing that she hadn't known, that the quail are like biddies, you know, they're sort of born with feathers and they go out and find their food right away, and that the mother can leave them in a spot and they'll stay there. And she said Dwight told her that he could pick them up in his hand if he found them, and they wouldn't try to fly away because they just lie there. And she said when he catches snakes, he has a book, and he says he gets the snake and takes it home and looks it up in the book to see what kind it is. And he told her that, he said, you can see deer here. She said, now she didn't say this, but I kind of got the impression this is what she meant. He was sort of letting us in on the secrets of the place, because it's been theirs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can't find a squirrel there because they've shot them all, I think. And they've just roamed that whole area of the land, Ronnie's land and ours, and that shack they camped out in. You find all sorts of bottles and cans and bicycles.
Yeah, so you're on their camping
ground. Yeah, we're on their camping ground. Their apple trees. Dwight knew the ones that were good to eat, and I thought they were all sour because we tried a couple of them and just kind of gave them up, and he found the ones that were eatable. They're still sour, but you can eat them. But he told him that if you get up real early, you can see the deer, because they come out of Ronnie's woods and jump the fence into our land and feed up there in the woods and in the pasture. He said, but you have to get up real early. And he's the first one you see in the mornings, stirring around, besides his father, of the children anyway. He's the first one up. And the rest of them kind of, as long as school's out, they stay in bed pretty late. And he's just quieter than the others. He's real quiet. He's real sort of, and the thing that Bew likes about him is that he's real sort of, when you ask him a question, he thinks about it a while before he says anything. You can just see him thinking. Kind of long drawn out, yes or no. And he says whatever it is. And Bew, he liked having him. He'd come over, comes over more than the other boys. He rides his bicycle around, and then he comes up to the barn and climbs all over it. All there was is just the framework with the studs and the purlines and the rafters on the roof with the boards across that they were going to nail the tin to. And it was just made for him. He'd never take a ladder up there. He's always just climbing and hanging and climbing up the post straight and up slanted post and just never was still. And I guess maybe that's why he can't learn in school, because he's just not used to holding still or something. And he'd help. He'd pass up boards. And he knew how to do it, too. Until I got onto it, I'd find a board. If it was one of those long ones, it'd go every which way before I finally learned out how to handle it.
Yeah.
And then I could do it without much trouble. He never did have trouble. He's smaller than I am. He knew where to get it to work with it.
This is Dwight.
And you would talk to him.
Yeah. He'd ask him. Well, I didn't hear a lot of that. I think you asked him mostly about people that lived around there, or his school, things like that. I guess kind of things that you thought you ought to talk to a boy about. And he said one time they asked about the family down the road, and as it turned out, this woman's daughter is married to the oldest son, Hobart's son, and they're separated, and he's 20 and he's got two children, and they're separated, and Dwight kind of worked his way around it without ever saying much about him. He said yes, he knew him, but he didn't know him too well. And you just thought it was kind of funny later. He hadn't realized that was Wayne's wife. Dwight probably did sort of know her anyway. He knew who they were, but he didn't say anything about it. Sidestepped. But he'll spend this long, long periods of time looking at the chickens and playing with them. He'll just squat outside the pen and feed them grass and watch them.
Yeah.
And he catches frogs for them and crawdads in the creek. They hold one in there and see what they'll do. Of course, the minute they see somebody holding something in the fence, they tear it apart. And he just watch and watch and watch.
That was up his house.
No, that's at our house.
You mean you got a pen of chickens?
Yeah. Those are Jim's chickens.
Oh, they're pretty big now.
Yeah, they are big. Scotty came over, right before we came down. He said,
"Oh yes."
He said, "Where are the biddies that came to my house?" Because they were sent to their house first. He said, "Where are the biddies that came to my house?" He didn't know those were there. No, I have to admit, chickens are a little more interesting than I thought they'd be. sort of a way. Because in the mornings when you open the door, you have this mad rush for the door, and they all sort of stand there, and more keep pushing till the final ones on the, sort of teetering on the edge of the... They start flying out just one after another. They don't even wait. They hit the fence sometimes and fall down. They're not too smart.
They're months old.
Mm-hmm. They're born.
That is the 10. They have feathered out.
When I left, they had all the feathers but the head ones, and they're starting to get those. And there's one in there that's got the biggest comb of all of them. And he's going to be the kingpin, I guess.
They're not all roosters.
I can't tell. Mr. Lyon says the roosters on a Rhode Island Red have a real thick, almost a double comb, and that the hens have a comb too. But as far as I've seen, the roosters look like they just have a little larger comb than the hens.
Yeah.
But I can't really tell much yet. But they come out in the morning and fly it up at each other. You know, they're going to fight. But Dwight likes to watch them.
And he'd talk to you about them.
Yeah.
If you give him a chance, wouldn't
he? If you give him a chance, yeah. He'd talk to him. He likes to talk about animals.
Now the next one, Melvin.
Kenneth. Yeah. Get Melvin. Yeah. Kenneth, he's a...
How does he come down there too?
He comes too. Dwight comes most, and Kenneth comes about as often. He's 11. Douglas is 6, and Dwight, I think, is 13 or 14. I'm not sure.
Oh, is it on your hill that he jumps the branch?
Yeah, he jumps the branch. Well, he starts, the road's coming at right angles, and he starts up at the hill about the corner of our land, and he starts there, and he comes down and around the corner and on down, because the road keeps going down that way. And then the way they had it set up, they had a jump rig fixed up right at the edge of the branch, he said, and he'd go up on that and try to go on over the branch. He just missed it. This happened the same day that Douglas came over and talked, which was what was funny. Nell and I were sitting out on the porch, and I was cleaning bridles, and she was just sitting there, I think, glad that she didn't have to fix supper already. He was riding down the road back and forth, you know, no hands. He'd pedal up there, and then he'd come down, no hands, and he'd hit the dip and sort of wobble and go off one way or the other. And after a while, he stopped it and he came in the gate and he said, "Did you see me riding with no hands?" He's loud and he's just always moving. When he's on his bicycle, it's always going back and forth. And he just keeps pushing it one way or the other, or rearing it up.
But the other two are not loud.
No. Not around us. No, but their house they are. Dwight's not, but Douglas is. But he just started in on his bicycles, and he's the first one he told us about, and this is the one that tickled Nelson much. We were both up there just laughing, and he knew it too. He was keeping us going. He'd had a brand new bicycle, he said, for his birthday, a 3-speed bicycle. And on that same day, his brothers dared him to try this jump on it. Jump over the creek. They'd been jumping other things, and they said, "You know, you're afraid to take the branch." So he wasn't afraid to do anything. He started up at the top of the hill, and he just got going faster and faster and faster, and he went off that jump, and he did something wrong, he said. He hit the brake when he shouldn't have, and the bicycle just went up, and then it came back down on the back wheel, and he fell off and hit his back. And he said he just tore that bicycle up, just like he's the proudest thing he'd ever done in his life. He really torn that bicycle. It's like Franklin came up to me at that gas station. He says, "You know what happened to Daddy's truck?" I said, "No." He says, "I wrecked it." Like, yeah, it was some exploit or something to be proud of. Uh-huh. But anyway, he said, he pointed to the back of the metal framework that holds the back wheel on. He says, "You see that?" He says, "That was bent out just like that." He said it tore up the wheel. He said it just bent it all in. He just kind of bent it in together. And he says, and the handlebars tore out, and it broke the fenders off, and it bent a couple of parts of the frame. He said there wasn't nothing left of that bike.
That one.
The brand new bike he got for his bicycle, a 3-speed. He said, I said, "Well, I guess that was the end of your bicycle for a while." He said, "No, we took it back and they gave us another one." He said, "They gave us a second-hand bike." And he said, but I tore that one up too. I said, is that what's out in our pasture? He says, is it red? And I said, yes. He says, that's it. All there is, there's no wheels, there's no pedals, there's no handlebars, it's just this, you know, the basic part of the frame. All that's left. He said he'd try to jump that creek again. And he said, but it didn't go across. And then he said, I think Nell asked him something about his parents being mad at him. He said, yeah, they were, kind of. He said, but I went to town, I wanted to put it in the newspapers and tell them what I'd done and being evil about. He says, I've always wanted to be like Evel Knievel. Nell didn't know who Evel Knievel was. He had to explain that he was a motorcycle rider that had broken every bone in his body, and that right now he's trying to jump the Grand Canyon on his motorcycle. He says, and he's got these big jet packs on the back of his motorcycle that he can, you know, when he goes off, he kicks them in so he gets more power. He says, and I saw him in town. I think he meant Atlanta. He signed a piece of paper for me, and he says, and you should have seen the girls. He said, they just scream and get close to him and just scream and scream and scream. He said, they haven't got any sense. But it was right after that, I think, that he was stung by the Evel Knievel bug, and he decided to be just like him.
Oh, I see.
You know, on his bike.
Yeah.
So he said his mother gave him $1.69, and he went in to see the newspaper man and told him what had happened to his bike and how come it had happened. He said, and the man printed it, and he took it to school and showed his teacher and all his friends and his aunts and his uncles and put it in his drawer. He said, he put it in just like I told him. He says, I told him just what happened, and he put it all in.
Well, they have to get the bug somewhere, don't they?
Someplace. Mm-hmm. We asked him how early, you know, if he'd been doing this all the time, you know, things like this. He's the one in the family about got drowned down the creek in the river where they swim, because he can't swim, but he won't stay out of it. So he about got drowned last year, I think. And his father, he says his daddy doesn't like him to go swimming down there, but they go anyway.
In the river.
In the river, yeah. It's real shallow except for one part, which is about, well, around where we are, which is about 8 feet deep, just right off the rocks. And they get up on the bridge, it goes over, which I guess it must be a good, I'd say about 20 feet above that river. And they jump off of that. You know, and the deep part is not very big. You know, the rocks kind of come out like that, and the deep part comes out like that. And that's the end of it. And they get on that bridge and jump into it. But I've never seen anything like it. All of them. Except Kenneth. Now, he won't quite do that anymore. And Daryl's a little cautious because he broke a couple of ribs doing it one day. He's getting ready to jump and his foot slipped and he fell and he just hit the water like that. He cracked a rib, I think.
Yeah.
That's where you swim.
And you remember that. That hurt.
Yeah, but he's got, well, when we left, he'd start down on the lower rocks again, diving and jumping, and we watched. We were down there several days, over about a 3 week period. And you could see him. He was getting higher and higher again. He worked up the rocks, and then he started going back over the bridge. And they have different level stanchion, and he was working his way up again.
Oh.
He said he drives a car. He ain't got a license, but he gets a car every now and then and drives it. He said his brother won't drive with him and he won't drive with his brother. They're both scared of each other.
How old is he?
He's about 15.
Boy, is he that old?
He may be 16. He's right around, he's in the same grade as Faye. He's about 15. He's gotten into a little more sophisticated than the others now. Like Kenneth was sitting down there telling us about all the good movies he'd seen, and the school had taken all his grade to see The Song of the South, that Walt Disney movie about Uncle Remus. He said, that was a good movie. Daryl was sitting over there and he sort of rolled his eyes. The things he has to put up with a little brother. He's a little past that. And he says he doesn't like living out there anymore. It's too boring. But he says sometimes it's pretty nice. Because he goes horseback riding on Ronnie's horse.
So. On your paths?
No, not on ours. He goes out on the road and rides all around.
And Ronnie's place is pretty good sized.
Yeah, Ronnie's place is big. It's, I'd say, about 150 acres.
Yeah.
That much?
Yeah. So he bought 30 acres to start with, and then he bought the rest. There was 230 acres to start with, and we've got 18. And Ronnie had 30. And then he bought all the rest of it.
But he hadn't paid for it.
No. And he went in, you know what he went into? He's not going to just have beef cattle. He decided he's going into breeding Angus. Purebred Angus stuff.
I don't know where did he get his toehold then.
Nobody knows. He worked for a finance company. That's all we've been able to find
out.
That's
all you know.
Mm-hmm. He worked for a finance company. And this house he has up there on the road, he didn't build it for himself and his family. He built it for his uncle. And it's it's about a $20,000 house. Yeah. And they were going to stay there on weekends. And his uncle was going to live there. So evidently for a while he had plenty of money. Because he bought two bulls and he bought a bunch of purebred Angus cows. He bought him a diesel tractor, great big Ford diesel, and he had that barn. He added to the barn, and he had a fence put around that whole thing. One like View had around his 18 acres, and that cost $2,000. About. I mean, it's some fence.
Is it a chain fence?
No, that's not a chain. No. Maybe that might be a little high, but it's treated post, and every fourth post they have in a railroad cross tie. And it's two strands of barbed wire on the top and hog wire underneath. And they had a professional fence crew put it in. And I think it cost, maybe it was just $1,000, I don't know. But Ronnie's fence is all of his.
You can buy a herd of cattle for that kind of money. That much. Well, now, he's an influence on those boys, isn't he?
Yeah, but they don't think much of him. They
he's
don't
the
think.
Brother?
No, Ronnie.
Oh, I see.
Ronnie's not any relation.
I see.
The way Ronnie got, let's see, the man who has the land or owned it is named Coward, and he's related to the Hobarts. He's their brother-in-law. And he's the speculator. He's the fellow that can put his money in anything and come out ahead. Except one time they know if he got beat. And he just sort of, everything turns to gold. I'd like to meet him because I don't think he's, I suspect he'd be kind of interesting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You haven't run into him.
But anyway, Ronnie, they won't say too much bad about Ronnie, but it's pretty clear they don't think he has much sense. I know the mother doesn't, and I know Dwayne doesn't think he's got any, because Dwayne says He says, any idiot'd know that you put $1 million into something, you better expect $2 million back or you're going to be in bad shape.
Yeah.
He says, he just keeps buying all this stuff
and
not getting anything back.
Not getting anything, taking anything, yeah.
Because I expect breeding cattle. You know, it's going to be a while before you get any return on that. Instead of just beef.
Well, you don't have much in it, much way of running into colic.
Well, not really running into him. He lives right down the street. You know, about 3 miles.
Oh.
He lives right down there. And he comes down to the Hobart sometimes. That'd be about the best one.
Well, your horse made you a few contacts.
Yeah. He would have made more if I'd been on my toes that first time all those men came over. I don't know. One man owns a cattle ranch and works horses. But that's the one time I met Ronnie, and he kind of struck me as a pretty easygoing sort of guy. He didn't know anything about horses. not the first. He couldn't anymore catch that horse or know what to do with it once he caught it. And he kept calling this little pony about the size of the Helsman's pony. He insisted that was a Welsh horse. He wouldn't let anybody call it a pony. It was a Welsh horse. Somebody has told him that was a horse.
It belongs to him?
Yeah. His son won't go near it. He got it for his son. And his son rode him one time, and the pony ran off with him and then threw him. And that boy won't touch that horse. He won't even come in the same pasture with him. So,
well, now, the boys, your Hobart boys, they
ride him.
They wandered over Ronnie's 150 acres, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, as it is now, this big house they live in is on Ronnie's property, and they work out the rent by handling his cows for him and his pastures and all. They do all the work.
Well, how did they get on in a house on Ronnie's land?
Well, first it belonged to the Hobart family.
Yes.
See, his family at one time, I don't know how that works. As we get the history of the land, we've gone back, there's Mr. Cowart who just sold it to us and Ronnie, and then right before him was a man named Daly who owned it all. Now, how he's related to the Hobarts, I don't know, because Mr. Hobart said when he was a boy, he lived there, and his family farmed that land when he was a boy. And the house belongs somehow to the family.
But it doesn't belong to the Hobarts.
No, it belongs to the Cowarts, who it did. They owned it, and then they sold it to Ronnie. So,
yes.
You know, the land and the house, too.
Yes. Well, he just farmed it for the Cowards.
Yeah.
And lived in it.
Yeah.
And now there's no farming to do, so he has to pay rent on it.
Cowart ran cattle, and I think Hobart took care of his cattle. And he's also a carpenter, you know, so he hires out, too. So now, though, he has to pay rent to Ronnie. And he does it by taking care of the land and the cattle. He said, it started out, the agreement was, Ronnie had just about 10 head, I think. And now he's got 60.
Goodness, that's a pretty good herd.
And he bought them all at once, too.
Oh,
within
my.
A year or so, I think, because when we were there, was it last year or the time we got stuck in mud? That's when he had 10.
Yeah.
And now he's got 60.
Well, that went up fast.
That's what they say. I ain't got any sense.
But you don't know what pastures he has.
Yeah, he's got He's got the 30 acres across from us on the east side, and on the north side he's got, that's where all the rest of it is. And they do something real funny. It looks like they've got the cow with the bull calves separated from the cows with the heifers.
Well, that's fair enough.
And then they keep one bull on them, on one side of the highway and the other one on the other. So
yeah.
They don't go through the fence.
Yeah.
We see him move them sometimes. Daryl has to, he gets on the tractor and he cuts the grass. They don't make hay off that. He buys all his hay.
Yeah.
But you can see the animals, the cows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they...
they're pretty...
The branch that... Our branch just crosses under the road and goes on through, and the cows come down there a couple of times a day and feed. And the little bull calves are fun to watch in the evening because they get out there and they play. Butt heads. We can see them.
Bubba made your contacts.
The one man I told you about, that I don't know what had come of that. It kind of depends if he ever comes back or not. But he just dropped in the gate one day and wanted to know. He wanted to look at Bubba. And he works for this marble quarry. And he dropped in and he asked Bew if that was his horse, and Bew said, no, it's my son's, and Jim was off someplace, so I took him up to look at him. I just he said, can he rack? And I said, no. He said, he doesn't have any walking. So once he'd sort of asked that and found out he couldn't rack, and then looked him over a little bit, then he just left Bubba and he started talking about his horses and all the things he's doing with his horses. And Faye had come up and he'd gotten off of some tobacco, just bit off his enormous chew, and it just tickled Faye. She couldn't believe it. And just shot his whole cheek out. And Faye, he kept calling the horses his horse. I guess like Barb does, sort of, but drawing it out. And he talked about he had a walker named Peanut, and he'd just been riding it that afternoon. He said, that horse can really step out. She's a good horse. He said, we went 5 miles in 23 and, he said, 6/10 minutes or something. And he takes this horse on these, the last thing he had him on was one of these overland wagon train sort of things, where they go from one town over the hills to another town, and it's about 50 miles or so. And he said that horse just bogs her head down and just nods her way all across. He wears a little pork pie hat and spurs, and he says, I just sit back on that horse, and he says, and all you gotta do is just put one finger between the reins and just touch her and she spins. And he says, and I ride her all around here. He told us several places he rode and gave a list of, I'd say a dozen people who owned horses and rode around here. And he says, y'all come on up to the horse show at Jasper Saturday. He says,
yeah.
He shows around.
Now that's all they needed, Faye.
Sure.
That'd be just as nice as Nick, wouldn't
it? That's what Diggle means. Yeah, it's just like a repeat of Nick. All I'd have to do is name's Red Fincher, and you wouldn't have to bring Bubba necessarily.
No.
Or you could just stick him in the trailer and not put him in anything. Just take him up there and then wander around.
Yeah.
It's just a little Most for the most part, it's just barrel races and things like that.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
But now Bubba got that nail in his foot.
Yeah, Bubba got the nail in his foot, and we thought Jim poured kerosene in it, I guess, in the hole, you know, thinking that we didn't have any iodine. He thought that'd, you know, keep it from getting infected. And he limped around from Thursday night until Tuesday night, and I came out there Wednesday, and his leg had swollen up to that first joint.
I didn't realize he'd gone that long.
He looked like he was getting better, which is, I guess, why we didn't do anything about it. And I came out there, and his leg was hot, and it was swollen, and I have unbelievable energy, so now I ran all the way up the hill to the barn. And told Jim, and he ran all the way down. So that, he had to help you, so that left me to find a vet. So the first thing I thought, well, Mr. Lyons will know what to do.
Yeah.
You know? So I went down there, and sure enough, he came in, and I called the vet, tried to, couldn't get a hold of him. He doesn't have one of those radio phones, and you have to wait till he can call you back. So Ms. Lyons said, well, they want you to call Dr. Pinkham. And he said, well, okay. So he called this fellow that, he's a retired vet, about 78 years old, and I thought, this is going to be nice. Because I get Bubba taken care of, and they're telling what he can talk about. Because he's been vetting the country, you know, ever since he started.
Yeah.
And Mr. Lyons says he's the one that took care of his mule when they got in there. So I thought, well, yeah, I used Bubba to get in the countryside, one way or the other. But we called him, and he said, well, he couldn't come because he just didn't make calls anymore, but he'd tell us what to do. He said, you have to give him a tetanus shot. And I sort of stood back that guy. I said, well, he's already had one. And he says, well, Mr. Lyons told him that. He says, well, he needs another one anyway. And Mr. Lyons' granddaughter is over there, and she said, you have to give a tetanus in 48 hours. It doesn't do any good in 3 or 4 days. He said, he says, just get all the antibiotics you can into him. He said, at least about 40 cc's. He says, can you give him the shot? You know, asked Mr. Lyons. Mr. Lyons said, no, his hands are too bad. And I said, well, I can give this shot. Confidence here. But he said, well, they probably have to ream that hole out. And the doctor said, yes. So we never did get to him. He lives way about 20 miles off.
Oh.
He said to go get Mr. Chadwick. Mr. Chadwick could help us. And this is what the Holberts later on told us, get Chadwick. He'll handle it. Because as Mr. Lyons told me, he got tired of trying to get a vet. He couldn't get, they're hard to get. So he decided he'd learn the doctor's own stuff.
Mr. Lyons?
Mr. Chadwick.
Chadwick, yes.
He's a big...
Now you hear that, Fanny?
Yeah. He's a big, well, he raises cattle, and he's got 4 or 5 big chicken houses.
Oh, I see.
Both. Mr. Lyons says he's worked every minute of his life, and he says anything he's got, he's earned it. He's got about 4 boys that live either with him or around there that help him out. And a couple of them are married. So we tried to get him. And Mr. Lyons says, now, he's not a vet, but he doctors his own stock, and he works with Dr. Pinkham. And what it is, found out, he gets his medicine and all his supplies from this old doctor and his instructions. And this Pinkham tells him what to do and how to handle his account. So he not only doctors his own stuff, he doctors other people's. The Hobart season.
Mm-hmm.
And they told us to get him. So, if you can't get a real vet, you get somebody who can do it, you know, without worrying about whether they've got a license or not. So we went over there. Mr. Lyons drove me over. And he was on his way to revival, so he didn't stop to talk. So he just gave us the medicine and the needle, you know, the syringe. It's one of those old thick cow needles that she used. And he said, now, he said, I'd help you, but I can't today. He says, but you be careful because a horse will fight you about that needle. I put the bad thing, I said, I guess so. I didn't say damn, I just thought. He says, they rear on you. He says, I don't handle horses if I can help it. So, that was another one that, you know, if he'd had time, we could have talked some more. He could have come over and helped.
Yeah, you just hit him at the wrong time.
But, I didn't think about that. All you got to do is find out what church they go to. And show up at a revival or something and just sort of make your acquaintance.
Yeah.
That's right.
Be off and running. Yeah. But anyway, we got back. Still no vet. All he had was the medicine and this one syringe and needle. And Jim looked at it and he says, you can't give him a shot with that. I said, well, it's all we got. He says, well, all right. So Mr. Lyons kind of supervised, and we found Bubba. He's up on top of the hill in the sun, just sweating, just drenched, you know, his whole body. He says, you better get that horse in the shade. He'd just make himself sick up there. So we tried to lead him into the barn, you know, where there's some shade, and Bubba wouldn't go. Hobble around. Oh, it hurt him so bad.
Oh,
he
put on.
He just sort of hold his leg up in the air. He wasn't even pointing it out in front of me. He was just holding it up. So we got a bucket of feed, and he came right down. And sure enough, the minute we tried to give that shot, he reared and pulled back. I guess it's just the needle too big. So, Mr. Lyons told Jim that what the doctor said you'll have to do is open that hole and let it drain. He says there'll be all sorts of stuff come out of there. And he said it'll stink too. So Jim just got his knife and got Bubba's hoof and started carving away.
Bubba let him do it.
Yeah, because it's in the part where he doesn't have any feeling. And he got up probably a quarter of an inch, I guess. And I don't think the nail went too much further. And then Bubba started trying to pull his hoof away. But Jim, it started draining, you know, just as soon as he opened that up a little bit.
Yeah.
He said, you're right, Mr. Lyons, it smells. And Mr. Lyons says, now, get some Epsom salt if you got it and try soaking his foot a little bit. So we did that. And that's all the vet told us to do when he got out there. He said, try that. 3 or 4 hours a day, just soak his foot in hot Epsom salt. And Jim and I kind of looked at him. He says, that horse's not going to mind. He's just going to stand there.
He didn't mind it.
No, he didn't. After the first time, he didn't. The first time we lost most of the water because he kept pulling his foot out and it knocked the bucket and he put it down real hard and it just splashed all the water out. But after that, Jim wouldn't try tying him and letting him soak it. We had to stand there and keep him occupied, just feeding. You know, we'd get a whole, about 6 quarts in the morning and a little less during the day. And I'd sit there. And after getting the water and the salts and everything ready, Jim would put his foot in the water, and I'd sit there and just handful after handful, I'd feed Bubba his feet. Just enough to put on there that there'd be enough for him to lick up. And if I didn't put it up fast enough, he'd turn around and he'd kind of look at it. Keep it coming, keep it coming. And he got some. He wouldn't leave that front pasture. He'd sort of eat grass up there close where he could keep an eye. And if he saw anybody, Bew or Nell or Faye or Jim and I, you know, as soon as he saw us come up toward the shack, he'd be right there at his feed trough. Just waiting.
Well, now, then you had to go to vet yourself. or the clinic.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was, let's see, I got back Saturday night, and Monday I came down with this, and I knew right away what it was.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe I'll drink lots of water and it'll go away.
Oh.
I didn't want to have to try to find a doctor. So, it didn't go away, so Nell vaguely remembered Mrs. Roper saying something about there's a clinic in Jasper, and they went to see a man named Dr. Roper. I thought, well, a clinic, that's good, because you don't have to have an appointment. You just go in and sit and wait. So I went to Jasper.
Well, I heard you did that through Ms. Hobart.
Well, we did, kind of. She told Nell about her doctor. She went to Mr. Roper all the time, and I know how it went. Nell had asked her. She said, "Do you know a good family doctor around here? Not a specialist or anything, but somebody who will take new patients. Because in some towns, get so they won't take new patients, you know." And Ms. Hobart said, "Yes, they went to Dr. Roper, and he just took care of the children and her and Chuck and anybody else that came in, and said he ran a nursing home, too."
Yes.
And, there
you are.
So Nell said, well, you know, we'll go down there if we ever need anything. And so I was the first one to need anything. I went down. And I thought, since she'd mentioned a clinic, it'd be a clinic. And what it turned out to be was this old, old house with sort of a hotel-looking thing on the back. This is, you know, this real dark wood floors and the wallpaper and all, and this ancient, ancient pictures and things. And I thought, oh no. And the nurse that went in, I said, would it be possible to see Dr. Roper today? And she kind of looked at me. I said, I'm visiting my parents up here and I come down with an infection and don't have a doctor. She said, well, you'll have to pay cash. I said, well, all right, I'll pay. And she didn't, she acted like she didn't want to take me. And so she hemmed and hawed around a little bit. And I said, well, I don't know any other doctors around here, and someone recommended you. And so she said, well, he'll be back about 2:00. He's gone to lunch. And I said, well, all right. Oh, she said, try Dr. Perrone down the street. So I tried him, and he was gone for the day, so I came back and said, I'd have to see Dr. Roper if it was all right. She said, okay. So I went off and came back about 1:30, and there were two women in the waiting room, and I sat down, and it couldn't have been more than 15 or 20 minutes before he was ready to see me. You know, just a woman walked in with her daughter, and she's in there about 5 minutes, and out they came. The other woman went in, and she went about 10 minutes, and then she came out. And I've never seen a doctor's office that she didn't have to wait an hour.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. You know, you begin to doubt their competence when you don't have to wait so long. This old nurse ushered me, and he's sitting there. He didn't have a white coat on or anything, just shirt and tie, and he's about, I'd say a nice 60. You know, he looked healthy and sort of vigorous, and he sort of frowned, and he said, "What seems to be the trouble?" I told him. He said, "Did you bring a specimen?" I said, "No." He sort of, you know, he looked like, "Well, you dope." He said, "Well, just come in here." So he. Now, this is what tickled me, because he had this shelf with about, oh, I'd say a dozen of these little round white enamel pans. He handed me one of those and showed me the bathroom and came back out and handed me this pan back. But it was so quick is what I couldn't get over. Not efficient quick, just quick. Usually at the infirmary, you wait and you wait and you wait and you wait and you wait some more. And you go to the nurse, and go to the lab, and come back to the nurse, and go to the doctor. So he looked at the specimen and came in and he says, yeah, you've got a mist there. He says, why don't you just go get this filled? And he filled out the prescription. So I thought, well, we can get something out of this. I said, looks like you've got some nice horses up there. He had all these pictures of trotting horses and Tennessee Walkers on his wall, you know, blue ribbon winners and all that. He said, yeah, I raise them. And he said, we've got a farm up here. He says, we've done real well for them. He says, I've got some thoroughbreds too, but he says, they're not doing any good. And then he just kind of cut it off. And I went out and paid my $4.
And then paid you $6 for the prescription.
Paid the $6 for the prescription, yeah.
But you had to have it refilled.
Yeah, it wasn't cleared up, so I went back. And I think I didn't have to wait that time. She just said, well, nobody else was there, so she just showed me in. He looked at it again. He says, well, it's still not cleared up. He says, get this refilled, and if it hadn't cleared up by then, we'll put you on something stronger. So what he was giving me was not sulfur, but a milder form of it, which surprised me, because he's like that vet up there. He's going to try something not very strong first before he puts you on sulfur. And, you know, most doctors, they don't even ask. They just give you the sulfur. So I was glad. If I was feeling as bad as I was on that mild stuff, I'd think it'd be on the sulfur again. But anyway, he said, come back and we'll check me. So I paid another $4.
Well, now you had, you guys have all sorts of connections, don't you?
Yeah.
You see, you could go to the barrel races and the little rodeos.
Yeah. Sure. Well, she's made one other that we could both take up, or I could take up. Because she's going to town one day, and her curiosity got the best of her. And we've been passing this house every day. It's an old, old, old house. It's kind of ancient. And the two old people are out in front of it all the time, just sitting on the porch. And so finally, she did what she'd been threatening to do. She just pulled up in the yard and introduced herself and said she saw their house and she just was wondering how old that house was. And that's all it took.
That's all it took.
She said they're the nicest people you'd ever want to know. Now she didn't report very well on. I don't know whether it was because it'd been a while since she'd done it or what. She remembered their name. They were Chadwicks too, and it was Mr. Chadwick and his widowed sister who lived in there, and the house was, I think, well over 100 years old.
Yeah.
And that's about all. One day we were going past, and there's a little white church, and it's just looks like not anything to it. It's just square and white and some chairs inside. And Nell had asked her about that church down there. And this woman said she didn't know anything at all about that church. She said she didn't have anything to do with it. It was a foot washing church.
Who's
Miss Chadwick's sister, the old,
yeah.
It was a foot washing church.
Well, Suzanne, when did you run into Ms. Holbrook?
That was just before we left.
She came to see you.
She came. No, I take that back. I met her first because Dwight had gotten a kitten from someplace. They had a cat and a kitten, and Dwight decided that this kitten needed another one to play with, so he went off and found one. And no.